2024 has been an extremely busy year from a geopolitical perspective. And as we're entering the last few days of the year, this is a good time to look at what 2025 has in store for us and what we'll be watching at Geopolity. Here to discuss this is Geopolity founder Adnan Khan. How are you enjoying the last few days of 2024, Adnan?
They've been pretty busy, but looking forward to 2025.
Definitely. So I think let's begin with an extremely loaded question. You're going to like this. Will 2025 be the year Israel and the US go to war with Iran?
Yep, definitely a very loaded question to begin with. The country that does want war, the country that does want war with Iran specifically, and probably the only country that wants a war in this region is actually Israel. It's all Israel's talking about. It's all Netanyahu's talking about. There are talks about a ceasefire and a permanent deal about Gaza going on. And all Netanyahu can talk about is Iran, Iran's nuclear program. If you look at America, Yusuf, there's talk of there's a mothership on the coast of the Atlantic and is sending drones into America. And they're saying it's a mothership from Iran. I mean, you literally couldn't make this stuff up. So it's Israel, really, because Israel senses the opportunity. It's sent Gaza back to the Stone Age. In Lebanon, they're depopulating. It's just in the last 3 or 4 weeks, just got an opportunity of a lifetime in Syria to set that country's military capabilities back. And really, the only country that remains that it would like to really set back and weaken them is Iran. And with Trump coming back into office in 20 days' time, as far as Netanyahu's concerned and the right wing in Israel, they've got 4 years really to do what they've always wanted to do. This is their dream, to really knock out Iran's nuclear program, weaken Iran, and send them back. So the question really for 2025 and what we're going to be watching is Israel can't really do this war on its own. We saw it with the two attacks they've done on Iran already, that when it comes to Iran, we're really getting to the limits of Israel's capability. So they need America. And they're going to have to drag America into this. And that's really the politics we're going to have to watch. Can they? Can't they? Trump doesn't like war, apparently. He doesn't want a war. He's been quite critical of wars, especially in the Middle East. Can Netanyahu drag America in? The Israelis and the pro-Israelis are doing a lot of work in America to really build up the momentum that Iran needs to be dealt with. Effectively, what the pro-Zionists are saying, we've knocked out Hezbollah, we've knocked out Hamas, we've knocked out Syria. The only thing that remains is Iran now. So I can't say definitively will it happen in 2025. But yeah, the drum beats of war is beating, and that's the direction Netanyahu's trying to take America in.
This has been going on for 15 months now, almost 15 months. And I don't think anyone thought it would go on for this long. Can we expect to see any resolution to this crisis in 2025?
I think that's really on the minds of everyone, Yusuf. There's obviously ceasefire talks going on. There's talks about ceasefire turning into some sort of permanent resolution to this issue. But I think we've got to put this into perspective, Yusuf. Israel is murdering, on average, 250 people every day in Gaza. 175 of these, Yusuf, every day are women and children. So these are people that have nothing to do with October 7th, anything like that. There's no let off by Israel. They've now invaded Syria, not just invaded Syria. Netanyahu has said that the Golan Heights deal was made with the Al-Assad and they've gone. So he's ripped up the deal. So as far as he's concerned, Golan Heights is now completely annexed. And they've actually gone further into Syria and annexed that territory. In Gaza, Yusuf, they've set up the Netzarim Corridor. This is a 7 kilometer wide strip of land that cuts Gaza into half. And what the IDF has done is the northern part of Gaza, they've completely emptied out the area. They demolished the homes of the people there in order to construct military roads and military positions. Haaretz reported just this week that Israeli soldiers have been told to kill anyone who enters this area. So what Israel's doing is depopulating these areas under the guise of security. Now, where have we heard of that before? This is the exact same argument Russia is using in Ukraine. It's saying that for our own security because of NATO, we need a buffer area, which is the Donbass. It's exactly what Israel's doing. But for some reason, when Israel does it, it's perfectly fine. They need security. When Russia does it, 16,000 sanctions are put on them. So going back to your question, when we talk about is there going to be any resolution? Well, how can there be a resolution, Yusuf? based on what I've just told you. Israel is actively committing a genocide. Human Rights Watch, Amnesty have said this is a Holocaust. It's actually taking place. So any negotiation, any talks, you know, Israel is giving lip service and still continuing what he's doing. So what I expect, Yusuf, in 2025, I can't see Israel doing any letting up on this. In fact, the last 3 weeks, with the fall of Syria, everyone's mind being on Damascus, it's been on Syria. No one's watching Gaza. The killings and the massacres are still going on. The depopulation is still going on. Nobody's watching Lebanon. So in 2025, Israel is going to want to consolidate this. Israel's going to want to make this trying to institutionalize it, make it permanent. And from an Israeli perspective, it's an opportunity of a lifetime. The Americas are largely backing them on this. And with Trump coming in, Netanyahu probably feels he's got even more leeway to do this. So really, I don't see a resolution to the crisis. I do potentially see a resolution based on Israeli terms. And the Israeli terms are very simple. It's the complete capitulation of the Palestinian people to Israeli demands.
I can see Trump being a common trend in this discussion. We'll get onto Trump in a moment. The next hot topic in the news is Syria. Abu Mohammed Jolani, he's gone from a former Al-Qaeda member to becoming a poster child for diversity and inclusivity. How do you see things playing out in Syria in 2025?
So at the moment, Yusuf, we're only 3 weeks in. I think we're 2 weeks in when Bashar al-Assad fled. We're about 3 weeks in. So really, that is an extremely short time to really... I mean, a lot's happened in such a short span of time. So it's quite hard, really, to look at what will happen in 2025. I mean, what can really outdo what's happened in the last 3 weeks? But if we look at what's going on, Israel has taken full advantage of the loss of the central government. And what it's done is it set back the military capabilities of Syria immensely. The Israelis say they've destroyed 85% of the strategic military assets of Syria. In the south of Syria, the Golan Heights, Israel's taken that over. And Israel's actually taken over what is formerly Syrian territory as well. In the north, the Kurds control the northeast of the country. In fact, 33% is in the hands of the Kurds. In that same area, we now know this week, there's 2,000 US troops there controlling the oil wells. You've still got the Alawites in the coastal region. And what you've seen the last week or two, everyone who's anyone, France, Britain, Germany, America, they're going over to Syria. They're meeting Jolani. There's talks going on. The talks are quite straightforward. We expect that. That's what the international community is saying. We expect to see inclusivity, rule of law. We expect to see a representative government. So they're laying down what they expect to see. And Jolani hasn't actually said anything new. Jolani hasn't said anything out of the ordinary. In fact, Jolani seems to be largely saying, without saying it, that there's going to be there's going to be continuity rather than any major changes. So I think looking at 2025, when the challenge Jolani has, or whoever the leadership would have been, your military is completely capitulated. Your economy in the country, 13, 14 years of war, you're starting from a very, very low place. So I think what you're really going to have is there's a lot of demand from the West. You're going to see Israel trying to take more and more territory. And I think very quickly, there's going to be a legitimacy question with the HTS government. Just finally on this, Yusuf, this week now, there's been a number of revelations from commanders who were involved in the conquest of Aleppo and the overthrow of Bashar al-Assad. And in both Haaretz and even the Financial Times, they reported that the groups that overthrew the regime in Damascus, they planned back in October to do this. So these are groups that were backed by Turkey and backed by America. So from October, they were planning to do this. And obviously, it was executed in December a couple of weeks ago. What we also know is the groups that came from the north of the country, from Idlib, HTS, and the other groups, they were managed by Turkey. Then you had groups from the south of Syria, see the Free Syrian Army, the FSA. And what we know is the communication between the north and these southern groups was via America's base in the south of Syria, which borders Iraq. So America is at the center of what's happened. So really from October, the overthrow of Bashar al-Assad had been decided. And this probably deserves a whole podcast on its own. What actually happened? How come for 13 years, these guys couldn't overthrow the regime? Then in 3 weeks, it happened. But it shows you that things are not settled in Syria. The country really is divided into three or four parts, controlled by different factions. They've got their own interests. They all want autonomy. So this is something we're definitely going to be watching. But yeah, 2025 doesn't necessarily bode well for Syria. Although I think we can all agree that the overthrow of Bashar al-Assad was something that was definitely needed.
One of the biggest things that's happening in the new year is Trump will be taking office on the 20th of January. What do you think his priorities will be? And do you think his second term will be much different to his first term?
So already, it's quite funny, before he's even taken office, already he's been putting out feelers, he's been making statements. He went to the reopening of Notre Dame in France. So already he's trying to put down his positions, what he plans to do. Probably the main thing that's coming out from Trump is he's now officially tariff man. He doesn't seem to think without tariffs in mind. So he's already threatened Panama. He's already threatening Germany. He's already threatening Mexico, that unless you export more to us or import more, unless you sell us more, expect tariffs. So already he's saying when he comes in, he's planning on putting 25% tariffs on most countries around the world. So this is Trump trying to deal with a trade imbalance. And this is exactly what he did when he first came in as well. The thing Trump doesn't talk a lot about is this project called Project 2025. This was his transition project drawn up by probably the most right-wing think tank in America, the Heritage Foundation. And in there, they talk about taking more powers away from the states and those powers coming to the White House, coming to the president. And we're seeing troubles here already. Trump is struggling to get some of his appointments passed by Congress. So already he's personally put forward for the defense post. He's not getting it. Tulsi Gabbard, who's supposed to be national security, the national intelligence head, there's question marks over her. So you're seeing this schism play out. Previously, so what happened was Trump, because he had no experience in office, he took the advice of other people and a lot of mainstream candidates who got in the way of what his strategy was. This time around, he's handpicking his guys. And this is leading to conflict straight away with the deep state and with other factions within the country. That's definitely something that needs to be watched. But there's a lot of old stuff that's back again, you know, the threats to other countries, America first, you're seeing a lot of that again. I think the new thing we definitely need to watch, which he hasn't spoken a lot about, but it's playing out with these appointments, is his agenda really to change the internal dynamics of America. And although on geopolitics, we focus more on foreign policy and relations between countries, the certain domestic things do have an impact on your global position. So that's definitely something we're going to be watching.
And what would you say are America's most strategic interests in 2025?
So I would say five, Yusuf. The most important is wealth distribution. America is a country where I think 10% of the population owns about 60-70% of the wealth. This is the fundamental cause for every problem in America. It's why people have lost confidence in politics. It's why people voted for a populist called Donald Trump. It's what's led to every problem America has. And the strategy Trump has to deal with this is largely, I'm going to cut taxes because they're too high, and tariffs. So he's not actually dealing with the underlying problem. And this is the fundamental strategic issue which affects everything in America. Number two, I would say national debt, Yusuf. Trump doesn't even talk about the national debt. It's $34 trillion at the moment, more than the economy. In fact, the interest repayment every year is now $1 trillion. So there's $1 trillion that is not going to education, health, or infrastructure, but it's going on interest repayments. The reason why Donald Trump doesn't talk about this is one of the ways you do tax cuts is that's less revenues coming in, and you plug that hole by issuing more debt. So the national debt's only going to get worse, and it's going to impact America's position. Donald Trump has no strategy to do with it. Number three, Yusuf, I would say demographics. In 2040, so where what? A decade and a half away, the Caucasian white population of America will no longer be the majority of Americans. The majority of Americans will be non-white Caucasians. It will be Mexicans, it will be black people, it will be foreigners. And already this is leading to a lot of tension. This is why people are voting for Donald Trump. And Donald Trump has a strategy for this, that is deportations. His plan is if you're undocumented, if you've come abroad, if you've come into America and you don't have the document, you are basically going to get deported. So he has a whole deportation strategy, which I think will cause even more social issues. Number four is technology. China, Yusuf, is really is far ahead when it comes to next generation technologies. That's why I'm not surprised America started a tech and economic war with China. But the problem here is the next generation of technologies, China is just far ahead. So despite them doing tariffs, despite them doing restrictions on semiconductors, I'm not sure that actually addresses America's technological position. But that's going to have an impact. And let's see what Trump can come up with. And the final one I will say, number five, Yusuf, is soft power. And I want to give you an example. About 2 weeks ago, Donald Trump tweeted and he said that BRICS is talking about not using the dollar. And he basically threatened that if you don't use the dollar, if any country doesn't use the dollar, I'm going to sanction you. So let me put this into context. The superpower nation in the world who is more powerful than any country, it can't talk about what are the positives of using the dollar. It can't bring the statistics to show you how the dollar creates stability. It has to threaten you to use its currency. If I'm trading with you, Yusuf, we would probably use my currency or your currency. Why would we use a third currency? So this is where America's soft power is, that America's soft power is completely gone. Hollywood, freedom, the American dream is gone. Now they have to threaten you to shape your behavior. So for Trump, it's about economic nationalism. For Trump, it's about protectionism over globalization. And what this all shows is that apart from threats, America has nothing else to offer. So soft power is really gone. So these are the five strategic challenges I think America has. And if you, you know, as I mentioned, I can't see Trump even directly dealing with most of this.
We all know Trump, he's got a bit of a loose tongue. He made a statement. He said that he could end the Ukraine war in 24 hours. Do you think he really can?
So Trump is saying he wants to get a ceasefire deal. Once he's got that, he wants to end the war. Now, I think he can do that. But what he means and what we believe is ending the war are two completely different things. What Trump is saying is Russia's taken over 20% of the country. Let's just call it a day. Ukraine lost that part of their country. And that's the end of the war. Now, the Ukrainians won't see that as the end of a war. They will see that as a capitulation. That is what Trump's talking about. He's basically, I'm not going to give you any more money. We're not going to give you any more equipment. And you need to come to an agreement on to end the war. Now, how can Ukraine come to an agreement to end the war when they're in no position to even negotiate? And what this shows us, Yusuf, is Ukraine is really a proxy. This is a battle between Russia and America. And this is not the end. This is the beginning. The Ukraine was just a proxy, but they battled it out. And when Ukraine comes to an end of the war, the battleground will move somewhere else because the competition between Russia and the Eastern Bloc and the West, that's been going on for a long time and it's going to continue. The current battlefield was Ukraine. So whatever the outcome of Ukraine is, it's not the outcome of, it's not the end of the underlying issue. That's why America doesn't have a problem just cutting their losses and running, because for them, this was just one part of a longer and a more broader battle. And I think this point's important because people have seen the end of Ukraine as like a resolution to like a world war scenario. This isn't the case. What this is we armed you to fight. It's coming up to 3 years now and we don't want to arm you anymore. So either you fight on your own with what we've given you or you just negotiate. And how is Ukraine going to negotiate when you're actually losing? And what I thought was very telling, Yusuf, is last week, just before Christmas, the NATO head, he gave a speech. And in the speech, he basically said, I'm talking to you, the people of Europe, you people in Europe who are NATO countries. He said, you need to have a wartime mentality. And his point was, is stop looking at Ukraine. This is a long-term battle with Russia and we need to get ready for it. He even said that you should accept cuts in healthcare and social security so that money can be invested in defense. So the long-term war with Russia has started. Ukraine is, unfortunately for the Ukrainian people, just one dot in that. So will it end in 24 hours? It can, if this is what he means. But the ending of the war in Ukraine does not end what this war represented. It is the battle or the competition between Russia and America.
It is crazy. We're already coming to the third anniversary next month of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. And I get the point that you're making about the US and Ukraine was used as a proxy. But what I don't get is why isn't there much interest from the likes of the European countries? I mean, Ukraine is part of Europe. They obviously are wanting to oppose Russia, but it seems like there's not much interest to continue supporting Ukraine.
Yeah, so Europe, Yusuf, they were in no position to lead on this effort when it started, because since the Cold War ended, they've been shrinking their military budgets. They've been shrinking their militaries. The British army at the moment is smaller than the Revolutionary Guards in Iran. And the Revolutionary Guards aren't even the main army. They're the militia force, effectively. So Europe was in no position when they started. And as we've seen for the last nearly 3 years, when it comes to anything, tanks and fighter jets and logistics, they want America to take the lead. They want to work with America rather than they take the lead. So despite all the claims by Europe of however long it takes, the actions are not in sync with that statement. The actions are completely opposite. Every weapon becomes a big debate and a big discussion. So even when it came to giving tanks to Ukraine, the Americans said that you European countries have got loads of our tanks, just give them out your stock. Like, it doesn't make sense for America to cross the Atlantic with loads of tanks. And what you find in the end, the Germans who've got the most tanks, the American tanks, they just didn't want to do it. Not because they couldn't, but they wanted America to lead on it. So this is why it was always going to come to this. The Europeans just are not invested in Ukraine and in the war the way potentially America is. However, this behavior by Europe, it's had unintended consequences. So if most of Europe, I think 45% of European gas was coming from Russia when the war started, 25%, a quarter of oil was coming from Russia, and I think nearly 50% of coal, which is still the main source for electricity, was coming from Russia. You now decided when Russia invaded Ukraine, we're going to cut our ties with you and go with America. So this is going to have an effect. It's going to have an effect because all your energy comes from this country and now you're at war with it, you're not going to get energy anymore. And that's why we're seeing problems across the board, especially Germany as well. In fact, the economies of Europe are a lot of them are in trouble, which is why you're seeing the rise of many right-wing leaders because of this underlying decision they made, which was to abandon Russia and join America. So they weren't invested in the war the way America was. They didn't want to take the lead. And despite these two things, they've completely messed up their own economies as well now.
Moving on to America's chief opponent, China. China is now the world's leading innovator. It's a green superpower, but it's struggling with its economic growth at the moment. What can we expect in 2025 from China?
So it's been more than a decade, Yusuf. China has failed to deal with a very simple a fundamental problem, which is that its economic model is no longer viable. China had a very simple economic model which turned it into a global industrial monster. It had an endless supply of workers, nearly 1 billion of them, and it was the cheapest place to produce anything. So China brought commodities, it brought energy, it brought metals and plastics. It converted them into final products, and these were put on ships and exported to the rest of the world. And this model worked perfectly fine until the global economic crisis in 2008. When the global economic crisis happened, the West went into recession, the double dip recessions, so they reduced their imports from China. So China realized that their model is so one-dimensional that they need to try and reduce their dependency on exports and to the West. But more importantly, they need to change the economic model. This is where they struggled. They threw loads of money at stimulating the economy, and all this did was led to a bubble in their property market, which has now led to China to become completely indebted. This year, Yusuf, we've seen two rounds of stimulus packages by the Chinese government in order to deal with the economic problem they've got. Now, in the long term, Yusuf, China looks good. China is developing technologically. China is ahead when it comes to green technology. But these technologies being the driving engine for the economy is still a decade away. So even though in the long term, China looks quite safe, in the short term, they've got massive problems. So I think in 2025, you're going to see more economic issues with this country. And you're going to see the government having to step in even more. Now, what didn't help was obviously COVID. They completely closed their economy and they really struggled to get back. So I think these problems will continue into 2025. None of these problems have got to the point where the regime's position is at stake with the social discontent. It hasn't got to that point yet. And that's something definitely we're going to be watching in 2025.
Do you think they will invade Taiwan?
Yusuf, what is it with all these invasion questions today?
It seems like that's the theme in 2025.
So I actually think China invading Taiwan actually looks more unlikely now, even compared to this time last year when we spoke about China. I just think the Chinese look at what's happened to Russia and they can see what will happen to them. Russia invaded Ukraine. There's 16,000 sanctions on Russia, the most sanctions in history in any nation. Russia has been kicked off out of the financial system. It's been kicked off SWIFT. Russia has even lost its energy reserve, the cash it had in financial institutions. Completely lost those. China is more dependent upon energy imports, and China is even more integrated into the global economy. China would be crippled if these sanctions happened to her. So I think it's even less likely. However, I think we've got to keep in mind that why is Taiwan such an issue for China? Taiwan is effectively the Israel of Asia. Like Israel acts as a forward base for the West in the Middle East, Taiwan is like is in the Far East in many ways. Obviously, you don't get Taiwanese Zionists. You don't get Taiwanese claiming indigenous rights or they believe 2,000 years ago, we were given rights here. So what the West have done is they support Taiwan, they arm her in order for Taiwan to act as a forward base. So the Chinese claim is the Communist Party is the legitimate ruler over all of China. So Taiwan is a rebel province, which at some point we will forcefully integrate. So that's a different military operation. What that is China will have to carry out an amphibious assault. An amphibious assault is the most complex military operation. It's where you will have to traverse 120 odd miles over the sea, land on the beachheads in Taiwan, and go and occupy the country. They cannot do what Israel is doing, bomb the country back to the Stone Age, because they want to incorporate the country into mainland China. So what you're seeing here is a major operation over the sea, and you'd have to occupy. Now, Taiwan isn't like Gaza, where it has no military, where it has a militia force. Taiwan is a very, very developed military, has about 100,000 plus soldiers, has up-to-date military equipment. So this is no walk in the park. You have to keep in mind, Yusuf, China has not fought a war in the last 55 years. Bashar al-Assad's father, Hafez al-Assad, was in power the last time China went to war, 55 years. So we hear all these stories of China's military progress, China's military development, and they're all true. How China will perform, we have no idea, because China's not fought a war. China hasn't even fought a war in the modern era. The last war, I think, was 1979 in Vietnam, and that was a completely different war with different capabilities. So I feel, Yusuf, in 2025, war is very unlikely. However, Taiwan had elections in 2024 and the anti-China party, the anti-reunification party, came to power. So I'm not sure how China can reunify Taiwan without the military option. Although economically Taiwan is integrated into China, politically it's not. So the only option really left is the military option. And the military option, as I mentioned, has a lot of issues. But more importantly and fundamentally, China cannot prosecute a war thinking is fighting Taiwan. If they go for Taiwan, they are really fighting the American army, and that's what they got to prepare for. And that complicates this process even more.
How do you see the tech war playing out in 2025 between China and the US?
So the battle and competition between China and America is playing out in different spheres. We've just spoken about the military aspect. The main one we're obviously seeing is the economic war, and the key part of the economic war is the tech war. So we've seen the Biden administration, and then it began with the Trump administration before, where what they're doing is they've not just put tariffs on goods being exported to China. They're now restricting and outright banning the exports of certain technologies to China. So for example, the machines, which are the size of buses that produce semiconductors, these lithography machines, laser machines. America banned the export of these to China. So this is like a central component, really, of the tech war. And in fact, semiconductors is probably the forefront of the tech battle between them. Now, this tech war has been going on really now for 8 years, and it's not really had the intended impact. It's not crippled the technological progress of China. It's not stopped them. In fact, we saw the new Huawei phone, the trifold one. They are using advanced chips in those phones. And it seems as though they bought up these advanced chips from other third countries. And we know that the next generation of technologies, quantum computing and sensors and all the other technologies, when it comes to the research, China is light years ahead of even America. So I think what will happen is when Trump comes in, they will expand the restrictions, I think, further onto every other technology and try and really restrict China getting access to these. In the long history of modern technology, Yusuf, we've had the Industrial Revolution. Prior to that, you had the West trying to learn how China makes silk. You had the rise of America, who stole a lot of British technology. So you find every attempt to restrict and monopolize technology, the complete opposite happened. So I think that we're going to be watching this, obviously, in 2025. But China is not a country at the early part of its development. China is someone who's poured a lot of money into research and development. And actually, on the next generation technology, there's actually possibility that some of these technologies, China will monopolize the final products that come out. So the tech war isn't playing out the way America wants. And it's definitely something we're going to be watching in 2025.
Let's move to a different country. So in the new year, it's likely that India will overtake Japan to become the world's fourth largest economy. What does this practically mean?
So when China replaced Japan as the second largest economy. That was quite a unique time. So I think it was the early 2000s. It meant you've got to take this country seriously. It's an economic power. And India has replaced its former colony. It's overtaken France. And by overtaking Japan, it now means that really India has to be taken seriously. And what it practically means is, why should France and the UK be at the summits of the conferences talking about global issues when they are falling down the Premier League of Nations? India should really have more of a say on international issues. India should be taken more seriously compared to other countries because they are struggling economically and now they're moving down the economic Premier League table. So that's what it practically means. I'm not seeing India arguing this. However, it could be argued that if India is got the largest population in the world, if it's one of the largest economies in the world, it has nuclear weapons, then really it should have a say in global issues. And it could argue, why should lesser countries be at the table when actually they've got a bigger economy? So really, you're seeing another Asian nation make its presence felt on the world circuit. If you look at it, Yusuf, for the last 500 years, everything's been Western-centric. Technological development, global economic growth, even global demographic growth. But the last 20 years, we're seeing a lot of things the West dominated shifting to the East. Technology, economic growth, development. And what India does is this is just another country that's not from Europe. You could call it an Eastern nation. And there's an argument here that really maybe there needs to be different institutions to these Western-centric ones. So all of this has a massive impact really on the way the world is structured. And the current structure of the world, which is Western-centric, Western liberal order led by the West, is losing its intellectual argument because of how large the economies of the East are and their contribution really to the key areas that give you power as well. So definitely this will be another thing we're watching in 2025.
As the Eastern economies develop, you're finding the Western economies are actually in turmoil. So for example, Germany, Europe's largest economy, it had a bad year in 2024 with the collapse of its coalition government, which will require early elections in 2025. Why is Germany in so much trouble? What does it actually mean for Europe?
So fundamentally, Yusuf, it comes down to one very clear and simple thing. Although the politicians refuse to address this, they're blaming other issues. Germany, when Russia invaded Ukraine, it abandoned cheap Russian gas and it sided with America. And now they're paying the price for it. So industry requires energy, and Germany imports 100% of its gas and oil, and I think nearly 98% of its coal. This country is completely dependent upon imports for the key import for your industry. So by abandoning Russia, that pipeline has got no gas coming through. The Nord Stream was blown up, and this has had an impact. So the industry is struggling, and 10% of Germany's economy is automobiles. And not surprisingly, Volkswagen, in its 84-year history, is now closing down some of its factories. Now it's actually planning to shift some of its production facilities to China, where it's cheaper. So Germany is in complete turmoil. So the coalition government that collapsed, Yusuf, well, firstly, the elections were due, I think, next August, September. Now they're going to happen much earlier because you had a three-way coalition, which included the Greens. And what the Greens have found since they come to power is all of Germany's policies have been anti-green. They've all been more fossil fuels, more nuclear energy because they've abandoned Russian cheap energy. So these were pipelines that were built during the Soviet era, and they took the Siberian oil fields and energy fields, energy all the way into Europe. The volumes Russia has been providing to Germany and Europe, nobody, no one country can replace that. So really, what we see in Germany is an act of self-destruction. And just this week, I was looking at the debates in Germany. They're trying to blame the fiscal policy, the taxation policy. It is quite clear is you don't have a regular supply of gas now. That's having a knock-on effect in your industry. As some of your brands, your global brands from this industry, they're struggling now. And these brands, they make up a significant part of your GDP. Also, keep in mind, 50% of the German economy, GDP, is based on exports. And it's exports of industrial goods. So really, Germany is in a massive problem. And Germany is the guarantor of Europe. So if Germany is struggling internally, this will have a knock-on effect on Europe as well. And that's why it will be... So there's already been a vote of no confidence for the leader, Olaf Scholz. That's why they have to have elections now. I think the elections are due in February. And it's going to be interesting how that's going to turn out, because is there going to be more of a shift to the right? That seems to be the trend, really. in Europe at the moment. So definitely in 2025, we're going to be watching Germany, because in the past, when there's been great turmoil in Europe, it was because of things that happened in Germany. So it's definitely something we're going to be watching, but it doesn't bode well for the future.
Yeah, Germany's central to Europe and the EU. With Germany in this particular position, are we seeing the center ground breaking in Europe?
Oh, absolutely. The center ground was, you know, the pragmatic mainstream parties. In Germany, the party Olaf Scholz is from, it's been largely in power for the last 30, 40 years, sometimes in coalition. You look across in Holland, you look across in France, the center ground has dominated politics. But really the last 10 years, you're finding in France, Marine Le Pen's right-wing party now is getting into second rounds when it comes to the presidency. It would have been the largest party in parliament, but they managed to fight that by making coalition with the other parties. But what you've got, Yusuf, is we had European elections in July, and the centrist parties performed poorly because these are parties that were pragmatic and status quo. And people have had enough of status quo politics. They feel status quo politics, you take care of the rich, you maintain the status quo, and the status quo people have had enough of. So what people are doing is they're moving more and more to non-mainstream parties and non-orthodox parties and politicians. In fact, Macron himself, when he became president, he had only been in politics for about 3 to 5 years. He was a complete outsider. In Ukraine, you've got an actor who, funny enough, was the president in his drama, who became the leader. Geert Wilders should really be the leader of Holland. They managed to keep him out, even though his party is the ruling party in that country. So centrist politics is not dead purely because the leaders have been great. It's people have just had enough. They feel mainstream center politics really just doesn't listen to us. Therefore, we are turning to people who do listen to us and have views of us. And that's why it's not surprising that more and more countries are moving more and more to the right.
Are we witnessing the death knell of the global rules-based order?
We definitely are, Yusuf, but not necessarily for the reasons people think. Most people look at Russia, look at China, and say these are growing countries, powerful countries, and this is probably the end of the Western liberal order. That is a factor, but the biggest knife that's been stuck in the back of the global liberal order has actually been the West itself. It's been the very creators of the liberal order. When Donald Trump is saying, forget globalization, it's about protectionism. When he's saying, forget the world, it's all about national interests. Well, what you're saying was the rules we set for the world, we're not going to live by them. When you've got a genocide playing out in front of you and you are threatening the International Criminal Court or the ICJ like a cartel would or like the mafia would, well, how can that order last when you are completely undermining it? So Donald Trump has done as much to destroy the global liberal order than Russia has. In fact, Russia and China really are a small dot when it comes to the global liberal order. The global liberal order really has been undermined by America itself, by its Iraq and Afghan invasions, where it lied about these, where it showed that it doesn't believe in the values of rule of law and justice and democracy, the way they always presented. And that's why when Trump came in, he just had no problem ripping it out. So definitely, we're looking at the end of it. Now, what will replace it is interesting, because China and Russia will say, we have a say. India will say, we have a say. After World War II, America was the last man standing. It could impose an order on the whole world. Now you have other countries. So this is definitely going to be a trend that we're going to be watching.
I remember we did this podcast last year about what we're expecting in 2024. And we talked about it being the year of democracy, because over 70 nations, more than half the world's population, were going to go to the polls and vote. Can 2024's new leaders deliver in 2025?
Yeah, so you're right, Yusuf. Last year, I remember a lot of discussion. There was democracy has taken some big hits last few years. So there was hope. You got elections coming up. Now, interestingly, Yusuf, a lot of incumbents lost their seat. Very few incumbents went on and won the election. Look at the UK, you look at America, you look at South. A lot of these places you find the incumbents lost their position with people running up. However, what you find is whoever, and some of the leaders we already lost, Sheikh Hasina got over front. She probably thought when she won the election, she's got a next legacy is secured. She hasn't. I'm sure Bashar al-Assad didn't think at the start of 2024, this will be his final year. Now it is. And whoever the leaders are, really there are two fundamental issues they're facing around the world. You find that they've got their work cut out because the economies are not working for the people. And especially in the West, immigration is a major issue. And the problem the West has is people are turning more and more against immigrants, more and more against foreigners, but they need them because of their declining populations. So how do you balance it? How do you marry these two together? Until now, they just keep lying to their people. They keep saying, yeah, we're controlling immigration, we're putting restrictions, but the amount of immigrants coming in is still in high numbers. So you've got economics and you've got migration. They are pulling in different directions. So whoever the leaders are, they've got their hands full. And I suspect we're going to see even bigger shift to the right, because I think most leaders would probably just make a decision that it's easier to pay lip service than actually do any of these things.
One thing that I've noticed is climate politics, it's not really been on the news that much. I think a lot of other things are kind of dominated. Are we seeing a decline in this?
Oh, absolutely, Yusuf. The Ukraine war, I wouldn't say it's the death knell in climate politics, but it's taken a big hit. Climate politics was, we need to reduce emissions and we need to have dates and targets that we're going to do this by. So generally you had 2030, 2040, where you're going to go more and more green and reduce your fossil fuel use. But because of the Ukraine war and because of the sanctions on Russia, Russia obviously is a global, main global producer really when it comes to oil, gas and a lot of minerals. So what you find, most countries dealt with this by delaying their target that they were supposed to achieve, that they pushed them further down the century. What you find, some have completely abandoned their target they were supposed to meet. And what you find is all the plans to close down power plants, close down nuclear plants, to reduce the use of oil, all of these have basically been abandoned. So one, the Green Party, that's part of the coalition government in Germany, they've completely lost credibility. It just sounds really unpractical. You need oil and gas for industry. And if you're going to say, talk about green and replace what we've got, Germany doesn't even have a regular supply of energy. So really, Ukraine is really the issue that has led to a big dent in climate politics. The emission target issues, I feel they were always questionable. You know, they're very arbitrary, very random. By 2050, you have to have reduced your usage of a particular energy source, or you have to reduce your emission. These are largely arbitrary. And actually, a lot of countries are already paying lip service to it anyway. They would go to these COP summits, agree things, never really stick to them. What it also shows, Yusuf, is fossil fuel is the fuel of choice. It's the way the world is going to move ahead. So climate change, climate politics has taken a massive hit. Not really, I don't mean it's completely gone, but it is taking a massive hit. So the life for fossil fuel has still got probably another 20, 30 years more in it compared to 2-3 years ago.
Off the back of Bashar al-Assad and the revolution in Syria, do you think we'll see a return of the Arab Spring in 2025?
So the region, the Middle East, Yusuf, is in a much worse position today than it was on the eve of the Arab Spring. So at the end of 2010, beginning 2011, you had the uprising start in Tunisia, spread to Egypt, Libya, came to Syria eventually as well. And you find the economic situation was bad. You find just the social situation was bad. And the governance just wasn't even in line with the people. And what you find today, Yusuf, in the countries where the Arab Spring took place, things are even worse. And actually what's happened is the condition that led to the Arab Spring, they've actually spread to other countries. They've spread to Iran, Iraq, Lebanon's already collapsed. It's spread to Algeria, it's spread to Sudan, it's spread to Bangladesh, it's spread to Pakistan. Actually, what you're finding is the underlying issue that the system doesn't work for the people. It's spread to the broader Muslim world and even outside the Arab world as well. So Iran, for example, has got major internal issues. Although its external position has been crippled to a large degree because the proxy groups have been completely destroyed. What you find in Iran has got significant internal issues. And a lot of this, again, is to do with the economy. It doesn't work for people. So will the Arab Spring return in 2025? The conditions that led to the original Arab Spring, they are still there and they are far worse today. So the Arab Spring should take place in 2025. If it doesn't, Yusuf, it will take place. It's a matter of when, not if. Because the conditions that led to the original Arab Spring, they are far worse today. And all the demands of the Arab Spring have not been met at all. So Syria is the first country where effectively the whole regime has been removed. So everyone's watching what this new regime is going to do. So we'll be watching this in 2025 as well. But the underlying conditions are all still there and far worse. So yes, the Arab Spring is due. Even if it doesn't happen this year, it is going to happen.
With all this unrest, the rise of the far right, we just spoke about the Arab Spring potentially resurfacing in 2025, China, Taiwan. Do you think 2025, World War III will take place?
All these war questions, Yusuf. So let's put this into perspective, Yusuf. Because of the Ukraine war and because of Taiwan, there's a lot more talk about World War III. Definitely, you just do a basic search. I find even my general reading, World War III is coming up a lot because of what we're seeing between Russia and the West. Now, the problem, Yusuf, we have is when the Cold War ended in 1991, you had America head and shoulders above everybody else. Soviet Union was no more. So great power competition ended at that point. You had America, the unipolar power. We went through the 2000s. Then we went through the noughties and America went to Iraq and Afghanistan. But despite that, there was very little competition to America's position. What's happened now, 30 years on from the Cold War, 30 plus years, is great power competition is back. You have Russia, you have China, you have them both combined in a bloc trying to get other countries. So great power competition is what led to the wars in the past. Great power competition is back. We're seeing this play out in Europe. The border between Europe and Russia, Yusuf, has constantly changed over the last 500 years. And the latest, we're seeing it play out in Ukraine. In the Far East, America has built a containment line around China. You've got China expanding as well. So what we're seeing is this competition is playing out across various sectors. We've talked about the economic war going on between China and America and the West and the East. This is to do with sanctions, to do with energy, to do with tech restrictions. We're seeing the battle play out when it comes to technology. Who can develop more technology? Who can restrict the other? Can you restrict them getting the machines that make the technology? You're seeing it play out in the military sphere with nuclear expansion, missile expansion, hypersonic expansion. So what we've got, Yusuf, is there is competition over the future of the world. There is competition on what the world should look like in the future. So America wants a world where she's at the center and she's supported by her allies in the West and they maintain the status quo. On the other side, you have China and Russia, both combined or sometimes even separately. They don't like the setup because it's rigged towards the West and they believe there needs to be multiple powers in the world or there should be regional powers in the world. So this is not an ideological battle like it was during the Cold War, but this is great power competition and war, Yusuf, is politics through other means. So the answer to your question, will World War III take place? All the things that lead to war are already taking place. And in some ways, Yusuf, a world war is probably inevitable. And what probably confirms this is the fact that the NATO head said just before Christmas that NATO countries need to have a war-like mentality. What he's saying is the Ukraine war is coming to an end. However, the competition between the West and the East, that is only just beginning. And that will play out. So not to end on a dampener, they are getting their population ready for World War III. They're saying we need to invest more in the military. You need to be ready to make sacrifices. So will it be 2025? I don't know. But there will likely be a war. But the reason why I say there's going to be a war, because war is just politics through other means.
Thanks for your time today, Adnan. Our full forecast will be out on the 1st of January 2025. Something to look forward to. We hope to bring you more content and podcasts and further insights into 2025. I'm Yusuf. Thank you for listening. Thank you.